Welcome back to the Daily Drum on SiriusXM channel 141 and 96.3 HD2. I'm Bramante Bryant in for Harold Fisher. Tonight we are talking about several days of important activities around several days, but it is an ongoing mission, a progressive mission, some might say, but I'll let the members of the organization that are here with us to talk about Equity Weekend. Our guests are David Johns, Dr. David Johns, CEO and Executive Director of the National Black Justice Coalition, and Dr. Marcus Hunter, a board member of the National Black Justice Coalition. Gentlemen, let's talk a little bit about, I thought it was interesting that, I don't know if it was Dr. Hunter who mentioned with Juneteenth, with Pride Month, and Black Music Month, how those three kind of have come together, you feel like, you know, when there's an intersection of that.
Right.
I would think some would hear Black History, Black Music Month and go, okay, how is that really, how is that tied to Juneteenth in Pride Month? Talk a little bit about how you see the music part of Black History tied to this weekend and Equity Weekend.
Oh, absolutely. First, we always have to give all praise and respect to the great and wise sociologist philosopher George Clinton, who said that DC is a chocolate city, right?
Yeah.
So what we know is that we've
kind of mocha now, though. Kind of mocha now, Dr. Hunter.
Hey, right. But we still gaining on them, like the chorus say, shout out to Bootsy Collins, you know. But the point being that Black music has been one of the very rare spaces where Black people have been paid, or at least paid something, to talk to each other. And so part of what happens is that we know Black music is a way to transmit messages about how things are going, about our well-being, about ways to be motivated and move forward. For example, I listen to the legendary Sounds of Blackness, Optimistic, every single day. You know, that is a very specific song that talks about how you keep your head to the sky. Shout out to Earth, Wind, and Fire. So you see how I'm folding all of these things in, because a lot of our messages about our well-being and who we are as a people is located in the Black music. Oftentimes, people are just putting speeches, thoughts, ideas to music in order to communicate them to other Black people under the guise of music. So it's honoring that and understanding its import and its power in our community to transmit messages of unity and well-being and optimism, and to make sure that that's integral to what we're doing. Because a lot of times, it's great. We know many of our most important leaders are great orators, but we also know that audiences need other ways to be engaged. So you also want to make sure that you're remembering that not all of our orators have just been speakers, but also singers, you know, also rappers. You know, so there are other ways that our communication has taken shape, and we want to maximize and lean into that and embrace all of those intersections and make sure that they're represented in the days that are coming up.
Dr. Johns, I want to ask this, and I want to preface by saying this is not a criticism. It's more to get your sort of analysis on, there can be a long laundry list, right, of things that the coalition wants to see get done. Is it possible that it could be too much to where the administration can't wrap their arms around, okay, what should we go after first? Or is that your position to let them know what they should go after first? You know where I'm going? That there's so many things to tackle.
Yes.
Is it possible that the administration doesn't know which one to tackle, so they do nothing? I just want your assessment of that.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. And three things come to mind, which is, one, it is the job of organizations like NBJC and our partners to prioritize the policy issues that we know matter most. And that's a part of the political process more generally. And so, yes, we accept that responsibility. The second thing is that one of the beautiful things about our democracy is the ability to handle multiple priorities at the same time. And so it is possible for this administration and future administrations, regardless of the political parties that they are associated with, to do the work of attending to the business of the people, regardless of how long that list might be. And then the last thing, Bramante, that comes to mind for me is that if we wanted to just focus on one thing, and that is centering equity, equity that would ensure that Black people, and particularly those of us who are most marginalized, I'm talking about Black women. When I say that, I mean that trans and cis. I'm talking about Black people who are also members of sexual minority communities, Black people with disabilities, Black people who face multiple challenges that are not a fault of their own. If we focused on a policy agenda, that center their needs, then everybody else would benefit too. This isn't just a David Johns principle, right? This is something that's been articulated in different ways by people, including JFK and Senator Ted Kennedy and others, but it's about focusing on the least of us in ways that we know will benefit the majority. Did that answer your question?
No, you did. I did want to get back to Representative Sheila Jackson Lee and Representative Barbara Lee, when you all had mentioned that they have not been able to get a meeting. And so I know I'm asking a lot of questions of why, but you all have put out there, this is what we want. And so I would think even listeners are going, okay, so why have you not been able to get a meeting when you have the first Black female vice president? When you have a president who really has almost admits that he, you know, got into office in large part because of Black people, specifically Black women and those issues. So, Dr. Hunter, why do you think those representatives have not been able to have an audience with the president or the vice president to talk about the issues that you all have talked about thus far?
Yeah, I think some of it is ill-advised. I think other parts of it are what I was raised up, my mom would always tell me, false evidence appearing real fear. That if you say the word reparations, shout out to the press secretary answering April Ryan's question, legendary journalist asking, and we finally hear reparations repeated in the answer, not just asked in the question. And there's this fear that if you attend to Black people's issues, now we've seen this over the history of America, if you specifically attend to Black people's issues, the world will be set afire. Or people will feel like it's affirmative action 2.0, or they will feel like you're targeting them to take away stuff from other people. When in fact, what we know is that the United States was founded on a premise of land dispossession. Shout out to our Native and Indigenous brothers and sisters, and the enslavement of African people. So if you are able to enfranchise those enslaved people and to create some kind of spatial repair with those Indigenous and Native people, that is necessarily a boon and a healing for the entire nation. And when we heard President Biden be elected, he said he came out of a semi-retirement space to rescue and restore the soul of the nation. And so when we ask these questions, it starts to be, well, since President Biden has been elected, we issued the first ever racial equity, you know, special order on the first day. We then did Stop Asian Hate. And we've closed the Black-white wealth gap in ways that have not happened in decades. And my answer is always, well, one, that's every president's job, okay? So those are issues that precede every president. Before you start as the president of the United States, at least since 1865, you have had to deal with the gap between Black people and white people. That's everybody's job. Thank you for doing that, but that's already your job. Now let's get to why you were elected. Why you were elected is because Black lives matter, because Breonna Taylor should be alive celebrating a birthday, because Mr. Floyd should be alive celebrating a birthday, that all these people should be alive celebrating a birthday. 72 plus million voters came out for you. So for me, it's also about thinking, and this is something that sits in my mind all the time. I remember when President Biden was elected and he brought George Floyd's grieving daughter to his office. And he said to her on camera, "We're gonna get this done for you and I'm gonna bring you back to this very office to sign this in your father's name." That has not come to pass. So the question becomes, as villagers, we know it takes a village to raise a child. Are we gonna stand by and watch this child be lied to? Are we gonna do things to apply pressure to ensure that she was told the truth and not a lie? And that is, I feel, a responsibility just as a regular, schmegular, degular Black person, that it is not okay for elected officials to tell our Black children things that do not come to pass and to try to silence us with Black representation every time we try to bring it back to your attention. Stop telling us about how the vice president is Black, the judge is Black, this is Black, that is Black. That is wonderful, but that's always been a priority and a need. Why you were elected, sir, madam, is to attend to issues of racial equity that extend beyond more than an executive order on day one.
Dr. Johns, it's an election year. And so it can be looked at in a couple of ways, as Dr. Hunter kind of, you know, mentioned, if you do too much, maybe it may look like you're catering to the Black electorate. But some would argue at this time, President Biden needs to do that because his numbers are showing that he's kind of got some lukewarm support from Black folks that he, which was much greater in 2020. So then the question becomes, would you see it as his to his advantage then to move along these proposals that you all have made to him instead of sitting on them? Because we've seen what's happened with the executive order with immigration. He sees that it's right. Some would argue that, okay, wait a minute, this is a policy issue that Democrats aren't winning on. He better do something here. Would you expect that he can then do the same thing when he's talking about issues surrounding Black and brown folks and marginalized communities?
Yeah, there was a lot there. So let me parse some of that out.
I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry at all. I just want to honor the thoughtfulness of the question. A part of the question is, does Biden benefit from, and does the Democratic Party benefit from prioritizing equity and or things related to racial justice? And the answer is yes, if only for the reason that Dr. Hunter just articulated. We are not too far removed from the summer of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. And I keep saying Tony McDade. Tony McDade is a Black trans man who was murdered the same week that George Floyd was murdered in Tallahassee by the police department. There are so many people who have not only been politicized as a result of what they experienced that summer, but who still care very deeply about us addressing those problems that have existed since transatlantic and trans-Pacific enslavement. And so there continues to be not only the need for it, but benefits associated with it when we think about the electorate. The start of your intervention, you named this being an election cycle. I think it's important for me to say every year is an election cycle. This happens to be a presidential election cycle, and I understand we sometimes overemphasize that. But every year we have opportunities to ensure that every elected official at every level is operating in a way that prioritizes the needs of the diverse Black community. And I'm saying this in particular because while the president is important, I hope people hear my heart, we also don't spend nearly enough time and attention paid to school boards, sheriffs and police chiefs, district attorneys, which is coming up a lot now when we think about everything connected to everything we're talking about. But we have opportunities to shape our political realities every single year, and I don't want us to miss over those opportunities. The last thing is this. This Democratic administration owes so much to the Black community. Period, full stop. The next paragraph is that consistently Black women and Black older voters always vote. Always vote. They are owed a debt of gratitude for the work that they continue to do. That's one of the reasons why we experience our President Biden name Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson and Vice President Harris as a symbolic reflection of that work, as Dr. Hunter said. And there is still more that needs to be done. The last thing I'll say is this. For any administration struggling with how to engage younger voters, there's a through line between young people asking for a defense of academic freedom and their ability to go to college, asking for protections for their bodily autonomy and them to be able to make safe decisions with their body, and racial justice. Racial justice connected to everything under the Black Lives Matter umbrella, and young people calling for the freedom of Palestine. All of that stuff is not only relevant now, will continue to be relevant as younger voters are going to hold on to this energy.
Do you think those are the voters which historically tends to be the ones that really push for change? Do you think that is constant and that's what you're going to see here in terms of even what your coalition is trying to do?
I named a number of voters. I'll say specifically that young people are always on the cusp of pushing any society to be better and to demand more. And I think that has everything to do with the fact that their synapses are still firing, they still are able to make demands, they don't get sedentary. That's important. And the reality is that it's hard to win an election without a coalition of support. And so in this moment, again, when we think about building the tent, the equity tent, there's room for everybody. And what I know in this hotly contested moment where we're thinking about the presidential politics, the person that's going to occupy that Oval Office is required to find ways to build inroads with unlikely voters, with people who they might otherwise think of as not a member of the community. We are all members of this democratic society, and it would benefit anyone to spend more time focused on how to engage voters that are not likely, are not usually seen as likely voters or likely to engage.
Dr. Hunter, I want to follow up on something Dr. Johns had said when he was talking about the importance of those lower level elections. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an oxymoron, say lower level, but knowing how important they are in the local level, district mm-hmm. attorneys, mm-hmm. State House representatives, mm-hmm. Prosecutors. You know, that is such a hard road, I would think, to get folks to focus on those elections, what those public officials do, why they are important. How do you do that? I would think that that takes a lot of boots on the ground, a lot of door knocking, a lot of flyers to try to educate people. Yeah. You know, it's enough just to educate them on the higher offices,
right,
the of the Supreme Court. How do you do that on that lower level, more local?
Yeah, I think part of one of these things is just also about why, you know, the nation's capital is such an important staging ground for a lot of these events that we're doing, because part of our request is not just for the president and the vice president to do executive legislative things, but also to use the platform that it has to educate the public. For example, we know that a Democratic governor, Gavin Newsom, and a Democratic governor, Kathy Hochul, have both put forward a reparations commission based on H.R. 40. But no one knows outside and tell of-
folks, Dr. Hunter, before you go forward, folks who don't know what H.R. 40 is, what is that and what does that acronym stand for?
Yes, H.R. 40, shout out to the glorious ancestor and one of the founders of the Congressional Black Caucus, John Conyers, representative out of Michigan, put forward a bill to create a commission that would study and develop reparations proposals for African Americans based on slavery. And it was given the name H.R. 40 in reflection of the 40 acres and a mule promise from General Sherman's Special Order Number 15, also made popular in the 40 acres and a mule productions of Spike Lee, the one and only Spike Lee. So people have seen it as a cultural reference here or there, but it was enfranchised as a way to mark this bill, which has been put forward for over 35 years, every congressional cycle. And so part of what's happened is other states and cities, St. Louis, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, Chicago, are all working out or in some process of reparations commission based on that very same bill. And it's important to note that in many of those places, while there might be a large Black population, it is not a predominantly Black place. So it's showing you that in a place like California, where Black people are 10% and decreasing demographic population, that they did a whole statewide first in the nation reparations commission, and they did not secede the union, okay? San Francisco did not break away. Northern California didn't become its own state. You know, Los Angeles is still intact, you know? So it shows you that it's just a fundamental part of a democratic process to figure out what the damage is and then to make reparations proposals that seek to repair the damage. And that's part of what's going on there. And what I say is, it is striking to me that we see that there's an enthusiasm and passion gap in voters around a Democratic Party, except some of the things that people want, like we hear no reparations, no vote. People think it's not happening because we haven't heard the bully pulpit say, I am watching and paying attention to what my colleague Gavin Newsom is doing at the governor level in California. I am watching and paying attention to what the first Black mayor, Karen Bass, who was on a shortlist to be vice president, is doing in Los Angeles. We are paying attention to what the Black woman mayor of Philadelphia is doing. That's not saying you're going to do it, but it is helping people understand that there's a wave coming and for people to prepare for that and educate themselves about it. And most importantly, what I think is the opportunity that is before all of these elected officials is that reparative justice is a positive story about a bunch of people who have been activated when philanthropy has decided equity is over. It's not being funded now. So these are people who are actual volunteers who are civically engaged in their government, making things happen in cities and towns and states. And I think it would be really meaningful for people to hear that, for our news cycle to not just be showing us bombings all the time, or the lack of a ceasefire, or the lack of peace, but showing us how people are moving forward in a peaceful way to discuss a very traumatic, painful part of our history so that we can move forward. And that's the request. And what you find is when more people hear about it, the more they feel encouraged about it, the more they start to see, maybe if it's President Biden I'm upset with, I'm not upset at the whole Democratic Party, because now I'm hearing Cori Bush, I'm hearing Jamal Bowman, I'm hearing Sheila Jackson Lee, I'm hearing Barbara Lee. These people are doing, I'm hearing Cory Booker. It's starting to sound like there's a whole group of people who are trying and making things happen, but without a big megaphone pushing that forward, the story gets, you know, confused. The story doesn't get told. And we're trying to help everyone see that there's a positive story that we can lean into going into this election season that I think will help deal with a lot of the trauma and pain that's all around us.
And the misinformation and disinformation that the other side is intentionally engineering. knowing what's worked for them heretofore and how to and them identifying these things to exploit.
And I would think too, Dr. Hunter, I heard the people you were rattling off, right?
Yeah.
And I think they were all African American.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
So could the counter argument be, or not even an argument, to say, if you really want to get this over the finish line, you're going to need some support outside of Black folks, Black leaders. You're going to need some white leaders stepping in, going of a prominent voice. I think, you know, Raskin has had talked about that.
Yes, and he's a part of our congressional. Yes, and he was at our congressional joint briefing. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're going to need more of that, right? Because if not, doesn't it fall into sort of that stereotypical, okay, of course, these Black folks are going to be asking for reparations. So unless you get some prominent white politicians who step forward, it may not happen. Am I on right arena there?
I think that that's not incorrect. I would just say this is part of when I get to the public information campaign that we are owed as the American public and voters from the president, is that H.R. 40 had 200 listed co-sponsors in the previous Congress. There weren't 200 Black representatives in the previous Congress. No one knows. There are over 117 plus co-sponsors of Congresswoman Barbara Lee's Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation Bill. No one knows. There are not 117 Black representatives. Okay, so part of it is to say the legislation we're even talking about has a multiracial constituency that has endorsed it. It's just that it becomes easier to lean in when you know that a national story that is being put forward is seeking to highlight the positive aspects of people working together. And this, again, is the missed opportunity that's happening right now, because the narrative is the government is dysfunctional, no one works together. But here it is in co-sponsorship, in joint letters, in organizational letters, people are working together. And the question becomes, why is that not being shared? Why is that not being known? And I just think that the bully pulpit is the largest speaker that we have in this country that can initiate a conversation and redirect the fourth state, known as the media, towards this story. You know, we learned when Donald Trump was president that a tweet from the president is worth 7 days of a media cycle. Where's the tweet? Where's the remark? Where is the comment? Which is why I always say it could just be something as simple as you are aware and you are monitoring and closely watching these reparations efforts. That is not the same as doing them, but it does charge the media with covering that story, breathing some life into folks who, again, have been abandoned by philanthropy. All of those pledges, McKinsey reports, $340 billion dedicated and publicly committed to issues of racial equity. Where is that money? Where are those efforts? And it isn't coming. In fact, without the MBJC and Black Lives Matter Global Fund, Black Music Action Coalition, and a few other of our leading organizations, we wouldn't be able to fund what we're doing, because people will have felt like the conversation is over. And that's, again, the responsibility of the president. So I don't mean to keep hitting on the POTUS angle to deny or discount local or state level things, but there's something to be said for the power that that office has to make things an awareness to the American public about what is going on. And what I fear is that if you don't do that, by the time reparations starts rolling across the country as it's already doing, people are in a defensive posture as opposed to a positive one about how can this reshape? How can this be an invitation to create a better town than the one I live in? How can this be a way to make this a better suburb than the one that we have, which is truly what reparative justice and equity are all about?
Dr. Johns, I'm sorry. I thought you were about to say something. Dr. Johns, we are in Pride Month. What are your thoughts on it? It has become now synonymous with June. Folks know about Pride Month. You see flags being flown. You see the White House. I don't know if it's been lit up under President Biden. I know it was under President Obama with the rainbow flag. With this month focusing on the LGBTQ plus community with Pride Month, where are we nationally on issues that are specific to the LGBTQ plus community?
I'm going to rephrase that and be more precise and talk about Black LGBTQ issues.
Okay, sure.
And I'll preview what the rest of the world, those who are not WHUR listeners will experience on Juneteenth when NBJC launches Black Facts, some newly collected data that was designed specifically so that we could have more informed conversations about where the Black electorate is in relation to attitudes and beliefs about Black LGBTQ people and policy issues. I'll give you three big takeaways, and then I'll come back to the first part of the question, which is more expansive. One, the myth that Black people are either singularly are more homophobic, biphobic, or transphobic than other communities is a lie built on white supremacy. The vast majority of Black people identify themselves as passive supporters or active accomplices in advancing issues that are important to Black LGBTQIA plus people. For people who might be thinking, what's on that list, David, if there are policy priorities for Black people, is there a separate list for Black LGBTQ people? What our data says is no. Black people, inclusive of those of us who are members of sexual minority communities or LGBTQIA plus, have the same values as non-LGBTQ members of our community. And I won't go through all of them because I want people to visit nbjc.org/blackfacts on Juneteenth. But I will underscore that this racial justice that we continue to talk about is one of the top three values for every member of our beautifully diverse community. And then the last thing is this, very much connected to this conversation we've had about elections, is that in spite of the setup that's happening, I'm very aware that it feels like mainstream white media is preparing to blame Black folks for whatever happens. Black women will be celebrated for whatever success the democratic institution experiences, and Black men are going to be blamed. That Black male narrative is in part being set up by a small number of Black celebrities, mostly rappers, who've had friends that have been pardoned by the previous occupant of the Oval Office, who himself is now a 37-time felon and possibly counting, right? They're using them to suggest that we are so frustrated that we are defecting from the Democratic Party and from voting en masse. And what our data shows is that that's also a lie. Black people have similar levels of high vote likelihood and are enthusiastic about the parties. The thing that we're focused on is that's not enough, right? The very last thing I'll say about this is so much of what gets missed when we talk about our righteous frustration with the voting process is that is simply a tool to engage with the system that we've inherited. A theme of Equity Week is vote and, right? So voting is just one part of it. There's still so much more we have to do to make everything else we've talked about a material reality.
And so you all will be in our last couple of minutes. You'll be all over the district, but you'll also be, for our audience purposes and WHO, you're going to be on the campus of Howard University, correct, over this weekend?
Absolutely.
You already know. People can't see me, but I'm doing my bison head. and so, yes, you can find us at HU and then affiliated to HU if you want to include Howard Theater. For the majority of our week, we'll be there for Out on the Hill, which begins tomorrow, June 12th. We also are happy to host our Rights and History Expo. That's at 4 p.m. in Blackburn. That's happening on Thursday. And then on Friday at 9 p.m., come check us out at Howard Theater for the Equity Ball. That's going to be a good time. Again, that includes Legends, Lego, and Open to All, and the gorgeous Jack Mizrahi as well.
Now, do folks have to pay to be involved in any of these activities?
The only event you have to pay for is the ball that is at Howard Theater. That's the only event that's ticketed. Every other event, we're asking people to visit us at NBJC or our Eventbrite page just to register so that we can know to expect you.
Dr. David John, CEO and Executive Director of the National Black Justice Coalition, and Dr. Marcus Hunter, also a board member of the National Black Justice Coalition. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us, and best of luck with Equity Weekend and all that you are doing for the community, all the work that you've been doing.
Thank you so much. God bless you and all of the listeners and the whole team. We appreciate you so much.
Thank you, Candace.
Thank you so much for being with us, rather. That's the Daily Drum for this Tuesday, June 11th. I'm Bramante Bryant, in for Harold Fisher. Have a great night.